This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Hello, and welcome to the first in a series of occasional podcasts from the Literary Encyclopedia. Every once in a while, the publication will bring together a group of experts to discuss a writer or a literary event. This inaugural episode celebrates the Encyclopedia's 25th birthday, and what better way to mark that than with one of the most popular literary figures of the 19th century, the novelist Charles Dickens. I am John Plotz of the Brandeis English Department in the United States, and I'm host of the podcast Recall This Book and Novel Dialogue. I'm going to be your guest host today, and I'm joined by four eminent, wonderful Dickens scholars from across the world. Professor Holly Freneau of Cardiff University in Wales, who's the author of Queer Dickens, Erotics, Families, Masculinities, and Enemy Intimacies and Strange Meetings in Writings of Conflict. Professor Giles Whiteley of Stockholm University in Sweden, whose books include The Aesthetics of Space in 19th Century British Literature and Oscar Wilde and the Simulacrum, The Truth of Masks. Also joining us from Stockholm is Dr. Jonathan Foster, who works on Victorian representations of administration and officialdom, a very excellently Dickensian topic. And Jonathan and Giles have recently published a co-edited book together on Dickens and decadence. And my final guest today is my friend from forever, Grace Moore of the University of Otago, New Zealand, who is general editor of the Literary Encyclopedia and the author of Dickens and Empire. Charles Dickens, one of the best-known writers in the English language, consistently appears in all-time best book lists. In his lifetime, he was known as an international celebrity, and he transformed the literary landscape of the 19th century. Famous as a comic novelist in his early years, Dickens' later writing is much more self-consciously literary and influenced a number of late Victorian writers, partly through its style and partly because of the ways it anticipated so many concerns of the last quarter of the 19th century. So one of those concerns, of course, was decadence, that feeling of used-upness or decline that haunted and inspired so many writers in the 1880s and the 1890s. Giles and Jonathan, you've recently published this book on Dickens and decadence. So can I just invite you to tell us a little bit about what you mean when you talk about decadence in Dickens's writing?
What do we mean by decadence? You can ask decadence scholars and they can't answer it. Decadence means all sorts of different things. Picking up on Grace's work, one of the things that we're looking at is this feeling of oversaturation, a rejection or awareness of the problems of empire. With that sense that London is in some way decaying and degenerating from a postulated golden age that was always a product of nostalgia and never really existed. So there's one sense of decadence. Another sense of decadence is that sense where Dickens's interest in things that maybe we don't always associate with him, maybe things like violence and sex can be read as problematic or as decadent tropes. And then finally, we look at the late 19th century. People have written essays on Oscar Wilde, Arthur Machen, all great readers of Dickens, all hugely influenced by Dickens, and therefore challenge the kind of Chesterton line that became dominant after 1906, that with Dickens, somehow we return to sanity after the age of absinthe. As he famously said, the age of absinthe is over, the decadents have had their day, and we're going back to the kind of cleanliness of Dickens. And we problematize that, and all the authors in the book do.
Jonathan, I'd love to hear your thoughts. What else you think comes out of the book?
Well, as you said, Dickens is primarily known as a humorist and a social reformist writer with a sentimental streak. And you have a decadent writer, Oscar Wilde, who famously quips that you have to have a heart of stone to read The Death of Little Nell without laughing. And this encapsulates what you would imagine to be the typical decadent response to Dickens, a rejection of his soppiness. But as we wanted to show in the volume, there's also this decadent side to Dickens and a Dickensian side to the work of many decadent writers. If Dickens had been this purely comedic and social reformist writer without the darker themes, I'm not sure his work would have stood the test of time in the same way. His fascination with violence and decay and the sexual subtexts and homoerotic undertones in many of his works, these are themes that decadence then took to a whole different level, treating them as themes worthy of lyrical or poetic treatments. Giles mentioned Huysmans. who was also a bureaucrat in the French Ministry of the Interior.
I did not know that. That is fascinating. No,
the joke is that he writes Le Bas, this novel about Parisian Satanism, on ministry lettered notepaper.
Wow.
In Against the Grain, you have this wonderful scene in which the protagonist goes about refurnishing one of his rooms, recreating a bureaucratic aesthetic using saffron silk materials to recreate the barren yellow colors that would be used then in offices that he had been working in. So he's redeploying and playing with a bureaucratic aesthetics, which is also then decadent, I suppose.
And there's some of that in Bleak House too, isn't there? I'm just thinking about Skimpole. Skimpole's really attentive to interiors and pays a lot of attention to that while he's reclining on his sofa doing nothing.
Well, I really like the do-nothingness point. I just wonder, it's a great way to think about the tension between the productive economy and Dickens. I mean, that notion that the problem in Bleak House is not it's a productive capitalist engine that grinds everything up. It's a really interesting way to invert those economies of labor value.
I was reading the introduction to your brilliant collection, Dickens and Decadence, and I liked the way you end with this claim for the decosification of Dickens. And it's just extraordinary that Dickens still retains this sanitized status as this head of family values. Famously in Britain, the Conservative government under Thatcher claimed Dickens as the figurehead of Victorian values, which is family wholesomeness and heterosexual reproduction. And we find such a different state of affairs when we read Dickens. And when you were talking about do-nothingness, I was thinking about the controversial figure of Mrs. Jellyby, who so appealed to modernist writers. Virginia Woolf talks about Mrs. Jellyby as after her own heart, that there's a feminist reclamation we might make, but of course this is quite problematic in terms of race and empire with her work in Africa. I know you'll have more to say about that, Grace, but I was thinking about the sort of problem Mrs. Jellyby presents in Bleak House as the opposite of Skimpole, that she has no aesthetics in her domestic setup, does she? Is it, everything's falling apart and there's bareness, barrenness in her house because of the neglect of her influence as supposed wife and mother to sweet order the property, which she refuses to do. She has no kind of domestic aesthetic, but at the same time, she's massively busy. She's this opposite of the do-nothing, doing everything, but perhaps she's not doing anything productive. I wondered what others have you thought about Mrs. Jellyby in the context of decadence.
I think that's a really good point. I think that Mrs. Jellyby can be seen to sort of like substantiate this tension between Dickens's politics at home and abroad. He's very interested in social reform and social justice, as we well know, and is well remembered for that. And at the same time, there is this deeply problematic issue that he's damned for turning her attention to Africa rather than looking closer to home. I think that that's also a sense of decadence. She substantiates that idea of decadence as far as Dickens is concerned, which is really, really double and problematic. If you look at the last novel he wrote and didn't finish, Mystery of Edward Drood, you've got here this remarkable reversal of the empire, where you start off with Jasper in this opium den in London, in the docks, and he's got this orientalized vision of violence and eroticism while he's high. And then he goes back to the home counties. He travels back, and with Jasper is the trace of this violence and destruction that's associated with the empire. It's like the empire is coming back into the home counties, polluting it. And yet these are all English problems as well that Dickens is addressing. And this is a theme in the book. This is a sense of decadence as well, this sense of division. An inability to tell the difference between what was once great and has now fallen, that idea of decadence as a fall or decay from some great point. So Mrs. Jellyby substantiates that in that sense, as well as the aesthetic sense, but also the political sense, and speaks to Dickens' own divided sense, which makes him so interesting and useful for us today. Period.
Can I maybe connect that? I think we're moving to this question of global celebrity. But is there a bridge here in which we think about decadence and self-conscious parody? There is a way in which that famous Wilde remark is obviously as snarky as anything Henry James produces about George Eliot, but it's also meant to parasitize or build on an anterior sort of fame. So I guess I was thinking about the way in which in Gilbert and Sullivan, you already get this kind of parodic quality, which is doing the work. You're able to hold up these paradigms of healthy Englishness for mockery in part. So can we think about that with Dickens? Is there a way in which he's aware of his own celebrity in some of the ways that Wilde was so obviously aware of his?
Yeah. I wonder if it's about circulation. One of the things that I find interesting about Bleak House is the way it's interested in circulating commodities, and in particular, the deluge of commodities arriving from the empire into England. And to just back up for a moment and think about Mrs. Jellyby, her husband is a customs agent and a really ineffective one. And it seems to me that part of the critique of Bleak House is about all of this stuff arriving. And that's something that carries through into the mystery of Edwin Drood with the way that it name checks a whole sequence of orientalized commodities, the lumps of delight that Rosa Budd is constantly scoffing. And I wonder for Dickens, as somebody who is so acutely self-conscious and so aware of his own celebrity, as he's thinking about all of this stuff circulating around the empire, whether he's also thinking about the circulation of his novels, the circulation of his own reputation, and the way in which he has that awareness. On the one hand, he's absolutely complicit in building that reputation. You know, he refers to himself, not always completely ironically in letters, as the inimitable Boz, but as somebody who is very aware of puffing and hot air. I think there's also a degree of parody there as well.
I think you're right. He anticipates then that sense of celebrity as a form of self-creation that you find a few years later. And we associate it particularly with someone like Wilde, but I think it's already there in the late Dickens as well. And he's ruthless too. He was ruthless in his career to get himself to that situation. Something that, again, we don't always think about with Dickens, certainly not if we're thinking in Margaret Thatcher's way, although maybe with John Major's government, a little bit more back to basics. There's a new edition I've seen of Dickens' plays coming out, and Dickens was a really keen performer as well, a really keen actor. And that filters into his sense of self, I would suggest.
And if you think about him as a global celebrity and his ruthlessness, or at least canniness in promoting that, the American reading tours are a big part of that, aren't they? Where he himself is the product on the stage. Yes. And I was thinking about those readings in the context of your recent work on decadence as well, and how uncozy many of them were, like his fascination with performing the murder of Nancy by Sykes and recreating this violence so that his hand was impressing into the reading desk, striking physically in his body. And then, of course, his dear friend biographer John Forster, who begs Dickens not to sell himself this way, not to commercialize himself, because he thinks that this is a lesser pursuit for the great man of letters, that standing up on stage and performing these fictions is a drain on his energy that he cannot sustain and is going to end his life sooner. So these things about the sort of generation or using up of personal energies are also in the debate about Dickens as a global commodity.
That's great. And it reminds me of a scene that he recounts when he's performing The Frozen Deep, thinking about the way he can tap other people's emotional energies and his magnetic presence on the stage. The play ends, and then he talks about the effect that it has on the audience who are weeping, and the stagehands who are weeping, and the carpenters who are weeping. And there's just this real sense of the way that he's harnessing and exploiting everybody's emotion.
Can I ask a question about global uptake in terms of what in the 21st century is like archive of their own or fan fiction or something, but just the ways in which there's an already appropriated afterlife where people, sure, they have their own life where they are doing their own theatricals, but then also they just become such a site of psychic investment and fascination. So is that part of the story of global celebrity, even in Dickens's own lifetime?
So you have examples of Dickens being claimed and taken up for kind of fandom in his own lifetime and just after. So I'm thinking of some queer collectors who wrote to each other about wanting David Copperfield on their bookshelves in the 1880s, 1890s. And then that feels like a very kind of recognizable interpretation of Dickens from the current fan fiction moment as well. So sites like Archive of Our Own or A3O, there's a huge volume of Dickens fan fiction out there, much of it queer, which is the section of it I looked at. But it's fantastic to see how that creative response to Dickens, which is most often a real interesting critical reading of the source material as well, is working to do kind of mashups slash fiction of Dickens characters. There's some wonderful Our Mutual Friend out there with lots of attention to Eugenia Mortimer, some of my own favourites. So yeah, I think this is along the lines of the democratic availability of Dickens as well, that people feel welcome, able to speak with Dickens and in a collaboration with Dickens. Maybe that's to do with another aspect of the global commercial aspect, but the enormous film industry, adaptation industry around Dickens, with hundreds of adaptations of their key works like Oliver Twist and Christmas Carol.
And that starts really early, doesn't it? I remember at the British Film Archive seeing a bizarre Tale of Two Cities from 1907 or something.
Yeah, it is early. And then that's building on immediate adaptations of Dickens, even as he's writing the serials. So those famous things about him going to the theatre, I think it's to see a completion of Oliver Twist while he's still only about two-thirds through the serialisation, and having to lay down on the floor of his box because he's so horrified at the way this story is being taken. So yeah, this is, again, a continuity that people feel able to recreate Dickens or work, I think, more generously in a conversation with Dickens that suits their own creative needs.
I love that phrase, Holly, democratic availability. It made me think about national differences, even in uptake, and maybe differences across language barriers. But is that a cue to us to think about the more recent reputational questions?
I want to turn to Grace on this as well, but I think there are some really difficult politics around globalized Dickens and how open or closed Dickens was to thinking with full equality about race. Also, I was thinking about how Dickens anticipates debates about hospitality and the openness of borders. With all of the discussion we had before about Edwin Drood, I was thinking of the characters of the Landless Twins arriving from Ceylon and whether they are fully welcomed. Clearly, Sapsi isn't welcoming to the Landless Twins and treats them with racism and is disciplined a bit by the text for that, but by an example of how to do this much better. It's hard to know with where Edward Drood was or wasn't tending, but is there a sense that they're only welcome because of the way they can kind of re-infuse ribund Britishness, that there's a need suddenly to bring in these characters from Ceylon in order to reinvigorate waning British culture?
I think you're right. There's definitely a sense in which they bring life into British culture and also life into the narrative. The English characters look so insipid in comparison to them. And they're really the vibrant force running through the novel. I've never really known what to do with Edwin Drood. And I think that's partly because it's so weirdly experimental. And of course, partly because it's just unfinished and we can't really know what Dickens was doing. But it is such a strange book and strange in its washed outness.
Yeah, shout out for Pete Orford's chapter in the Dickens and Decadence collection. Pete, as one of the experts on Edwin Drood, thinking about that atrophy of British institutions and the need for a reinvigoration in both metropolitan and more rural spaces. I think it very much depends on what would have happened in the continued plot lines for Helena particularly. And then it feels dangerous to speculate that Dickens is going to suddenly do something much more radical in terms of race than he's ever done before, when he doesn't actually do that, as the novel doesn't quite get there.
Grace, you're of course right that I do feel very lively with the Landless Twins when they arrive. But one wonders to what extent that's our later impression upon the text and to what extent that liveliness is going to be damned as disruptive by Dickens, which would be to return to some of the types that we've seen beforehand. A few years ago, Dickens Quarterly decided that they needed to make a statement about Dickens and race, and then they did a special issue 2022 about this. This is a long, problematic shadow still over Dickens's relevance and reception and things like that.
If you think about that long shadow, how does that long shadow connect with our changing understanding of colonial and settler colonial dynamics for making sense of the legacy of liberalism triumphant, the legacy of liberalism understood as just subterfuge for imperial ambition? Have you noticed interesting trend lines that enable us to use Dickens to think about empire and its omnipresence and are interesting things emerging?
I think, you know, one of the interesting things is to go back to Holly's point about afterlives, the way that Dickens kind of develops those afterlives in his own lifetime and the way the circulation of his work across the empire inevitably picks up this weird momentum where Dickens is being reinvented, even as the installments of his works are appearing. Sue Martin and Kylie Mermer-Hamadi, two Australian scholars, wrote a brilliant book about a decade ago now, Colonial Dickens. And one of the things that they're really interested in is the way that Australian settlers used installments of Dickens as a way of navigating their feelings of homesickness and nostalgia for the old country and isolation in their new environment. They've done a huge amount of archival research and they have accounts of people wandering around metropolitan Melbourne, trying to view it through the lens of Bleak House and seeing it as this kind of London labyrinth. And that's kind of an act of will because, of course, climatically, it's so different. It's hot. The climate is oppressive. But there is this pang for the mother country that requires some kind of connection. And Dickens is that way of forming a connection.
The point about reimagining the various cities is fascinating here that that's going on so far. I've seen that constantly in European writing, in Austria, in French writing, in German, Italian writing, and later British writing. Henry James, the first thing he does when he arrives in London is he goes down to see the sights of Oliver Twist. It's the first thing he does, an American who's been in Paris for a bit and now comes over to London. You know, that's what you do. You go and do your Dickens as a way of understanding where it is you're going. But that's London, Prague, all of these different European cities during the modernist period are constantly being reimagined. So it's very interesting to hear that it's going on so much further afield as well, very similar kinds of works.
The examples that you're citing, Giles, are about literary tourism. What I see happening in Australia is much more about trauma and the rupture of being a migrant. Dickens has this dual utility in that way.
I can speak to this topic from my own interests in literature and bureaucracy. Imaginary is something that interests me a lot. And there you have later writers setting their own narratives about the British Civil Service in the Circumlocution Office and repurposing to fit their own needs when they're writing. For instance, Edward Shanks writes The Old Indispensables. It's this war novel where he's writing about the descendants of Type Barnacle of the Circumlocution Office. At that stage, there's only one remaining survivor of the clan of the Barnacles. Women clerks or women civil servants have been introduced and he is being crowded out or he's being replaced. He's out of place at this stage. Writers were still very much using the Dickensian sort of bureaucratic catchphrases and his imaginary to make sense of the civil service as it developed over the long 19th century.
Can I again take my non-Dickensian hat to ask, does Joyce, in terms of spatialization of city, is there any sense that he's thinking through the proprietary prior ownership of London in his vision of Dublin, or is it just doing something different?
A bit of both, Sean. I mean, it is different. Joyce knows Dublin in a way that no one else ever knew and manages to write it in a way that brings it all alive. It's history and it's present and everything. You can walk with Dubliners, or you can walk with Ulysses, and you can literally walk the city and see everything and live it. But you can do the same pretty much with Dickens's London, and he's clearly learnt from Dickens's London, that kind of overbearing presence that filters through to the modernists. Another point of contact would be something like Mrs. Dalloway, which is also deeply indebted, but there more directly to Dickens's version of London. But yeah, I wrote a book a few years ago on the aesthetics of space, and at the end of that book, I end with Joyce and Wolfe and look at those modernist heirs, which are clearly deeply indebted to Dickens. So yes, a bit of both would be my answer.
So I have a note here to bring up this question of the neo-Victorian revision, which I imagine, Grace, you could pick it up, I'm sure, in an Australian direction and talk about Magwitch, but you could think more extravagantly of just the steampunk world that is inherited out of a kind of Dickensian sensibility. And in my mind, this is somehow connected to the weird new world of book talk and what it means for young readers to reanimate it in a way, just really picking up, Holly, on your concept of the democratic availability of Dickens.
The thing about neo-Victorian stuff is that it's completely impossible without Dickens. And the point there is that our understanding of the Victorians is so mediated through Dickens still today in different ways, certainly as a literary and aesthetic phenomenon, that the steampunk version of any Victorian cityscape is obviously a modified version, but is so indebted to Dickens that it would be impossible without Dickens.
Yeah, he's definitely a touchstone in terms of revisionism. I'm thinking particularly in the 90s and early 2000s. And John, you mentioned Peter Carey. He's the obvious example. But I've been rereading Lloyd Jones's Mr. Pip this year because I've been teaching it. And that does something a little bit different. It sort of uses the Bildungsroman, it uses the Great Expectations story, but it does so through the narrative of a character, Matilda, who is being read to. She's hearing the story of Great Expectations in war-torn Bougainville. And then the book is taken away and she and her classmates reconstruct that story, but then ultimately reject it. And Matilda realizes that it's not her story at all. And so I think, you know, that process of engaging with those texts is also a process of rejecting and moving on from them and shaking away the imperial legacy and also shaking away that artistic legacy of Dickens too, which weighs very heavily. It is impossible without Dickens, but also the presence of Dickens makes other things impossible. You know, he is such a presence that there needs to be some kind of moving on from him.
Yeah, it's not a neo-Victorian novel, but I keep thinking of the example of Ali Smith's novel Spring, which uses the not very well-known Dickens story, Seven Poor Travellers, his Christmas number of 1854, in a really surprising way to advocate for a greater openness to migrants. She has this story interlaced through a telling of the violence done to migrants at British detention centres. And she uses Dickens' Seven Poor Travellers to ask for better reconciliation across nations. His story has a French and British military enemy reconciled, and Smith plays with this. So yeah, I was thinking about the decision to use very little known Dickens piece as another way to maybe engage that issue of influence or concern around how Dickens dominates our ability to reimagine, but also a choice to claim Dickens for cosmopolitanism. She, as well as a novelist, is an advocate for refugee rights and clearly using Dickens in a very hopeful way to say, well, let's invoke this huge cultural figure in order to try to encourage us to think better, greater empathy, relate better.
Yeah, that's a really nice positive use of Dickens. What you're describing is the way that Smith is harnessing Dickens's compassion, for which he's so famous, even though the Dickens we know, the Dickens who says all of these dreadful racist things in the 1850s, might not have been an advocate for migrants and refugees. So I like the way that Smith is updating that.
Yeah, if a little problematically, that then Dickens does suddenly become a poster boy for softer borders. I agree with you that that's not necessarily where his own politics went.
Giles, you began with the invocation of the omnipresence of these theatrical affordances, the forms that allow a neo-Victorian. And speaking as someone who's advised a lot of graduate master's theses, I know the appeal of the high stock collar and Victorian sci-fi. It's not positive exactly, but it's an enabling affordance. But your image, Grace, is an image of, you know, anxiety of influence or the burden of the past on the English poet or something, the things you have to bury in order to be able to move on.
Thinking this through in relation to post-colonial reworkings of Dickens, and it's not just Dickens, there are reworkings of the Brontes too, of course. But I think he's such a dominant feature, even today, on high school syllabi in decolonized countries, that there has to be a kind of pushing through Dickens, that people are exposed to Dickens at formative moments, usually in their adolescence. And to begin with, there is that coziness with which we began our conversation. And then there's that process of decosification that Giles and Jonathan have been talking about, as readers realize that this is not just about firesides and ghost stories at Christmas time.
And 10-pound notes, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And this whole unpleasant underbelly to Dickens the writer, the person, but also often to the novels too, whether you're thinking about the source of wealth in Great Expectations or the source of the cotton that is driving the factories in Hard Times. You know, there's a colonial subtext to all of Dickens. And so I think inevitably there has to be a moment for the post-colonial reader of Dickens where that has to be thrown up and thrown out. And Peter Carey does this really nicely at the end of Jack Mags, where he just imagines a fire. And there's this conflagration at the end of the novel where the Magwitch figure has just chosen to leave.
You do love a fire, Grace. You always love a fire.
Always good to come back to a fire.
Yeah.
But the Magwitch figure, Jack Mags, just decides that he's done with these obnoxious, entitled, spoiled English characters. He's going back to Australia. He wants nothing to do with them because they're just not important. They don't have a part in the Australian settler story. And Carey is sufficiently self-aware to know that there are problems with his own ending. He knows that this is very much a settler story. He knows that there's another story, there's an Indigenous story behind Jack Mags, behind the Great Expectations story too, but he also knows that that is not his story to tell. And he gestures to it at moments towards the end of the novel where he's thinking about Jack's hybrid children. He talks about the texture of their hair. He signals that perhaps Mags's partner is an Indigenous woman, but that's as far as he's willing to go because he simply can't tell that story. He just needs to point to it and note that there is definitely another darker, bloodier story behind Great Expectations.
I am tempted to take this as a moment, if we're ready, to turn towards the home stretch. And I have in my home stretch possibilities too. And I think you have to choose how cozy or uncozy you want to go with your Dickensian ending. So one version is to ask you in true Dickens world spirit to talk about what Dickens character you think you are. And the other is to ask if, in maybe more scholarly way, if you wanted to talk about a favorite, lesser-known piece of Dickens writing.
I kind of want to hear what Dickens character everybody thinks okay. they are.
All right, then.
Real prurience, I think, on my part.
It depends on how deep we have to be about this. I don't want to psychoanalyze myself too much through the text.
I was asked this question years ago, I think in 2012, at the end of a radio show, and my mind went completely blank. And, you know, at that moment, the only character I could think of was Quilp, but I couldn't think of any reasons. It was just a horrible moment.
Oh, that is brilliant for decosification. Oh, great. Yeah, I have an answer to this because I had the chance to enact this character in what was then called Twitter. We had this reading project in partnership with Birkbeck, where we tried to tell our mutual friend through lots of people taking on a character and tweeting as that character through the installments of the novel. And I was really happy that I got to be Mortimer. I'd really wanted to, and everybody had to keep their identity secret. So the whole time I was wondering who was my beloved Eugene. And then there was a conference at the end where the revelation was made. And it was all wonderfully exciting. But yeah, there's something about me that really wants to be Mortimer Lightwood. And I'm not quite sure what that is. That is, I'm definitely not Eugene. I think I'm holding the flame for the decadent without being it myself.
Right. Jonathan, do you have one for us?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about the neo-Victorian trend or moment. You could almost see this being an online test you could take. Which Dickens character are you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
You could fill in some personal information and then get the label. I like the anti-heroes and the strange characters of Dickens' worlds. Maybe Crook from Bleak House. He's this really vile character, but he's rather harmless, I think. I mean, he's kind of vicious, but he's just adding to his stock of useless items. And I can relate to that, I think, somehow.
Oh, that's brilliant. And another fire for Grace.
Yeah,
seriously. Yeah, it's the best death.
Greasy rag day on the podcast. Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. And Giles, what do you got?
One of his characters who doesn't always know when they shouldn't speak. Without the drunkenness, someone like Durdles, who sort of has this license to just say whatever he wants to everyone in the social circle, but without his more problematic areas. But one of those people who, Dickens is full of these almost like Feste from Twelfth Night sort of characters who just skate around in the margins and say it like they see it. And not in a cruel way, but in a way that reveals how ridiculous things are.
Is Sam Weller one of those?
Yeah, Sam is another one with his Wellerisms. Maybe a more sympathetic one in some respect, although maybe a bit too young and too mischievous for me.
Mm. Well, I think I just got to end here by thanking all of you, Giles, Jonathan, Holly, and especially Grace. Thank you all. This podcast was brought to you by the Literary Encyclopedia, which is an online publication containing more than 10,000 articles about books and their authors. And the Literary Encyclopedia is published independently by the Literary Dictionary Company. And its publisher is Robert Clark. Thank you all. And from all of us, thanks for listening.
Find us online at www.litencyc.com and sign up for a free trial.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.